From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on September 10th in Manhattan when Vice President Joe Biden joined Governor Andrew Cuomo for an event. And with the Vice President alongside, Governor Cuomo declared that he would be the champion of the working class that he had promised to be on the campaign trail. And the governor said, it's time for a $15 minimum wage, not just for the fast food industry, but for everyone. That is a dramatic proposal that would bring the state minimum wage to more than double the current federal minimum wage of $7.25. Earlier this year, the governor's appointed wage board recommended a $15 minimum for the fast food industry, but now the governor says it should be across the board. Several American cities have passed an increase to $15 an hour, Seattle and Los Angeles leading the way, but no state has done the same, and Cuomo wants that to change. That has sparked debate about what the impact would be of such an increase here. This hour, our panel will discuss that. My guests include Kent Gardner, the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Kent, nice to see you back.
Nice to be back.
Chris Wiest is the vice president of public policy with the Rochester Business Alliance. Chris, nice to have you.
Thanks for inviting me, Dubby.
And Colin O'Malley, the organizing director for Metro Justice. Colin, nice to have you as well.
Thank you. Always fun.
All right, let's start with what the governor had to say that day. We're going to listen to Governor Andrew Cuomo talking about why he thinks it is time for $15 as a minimum wage.
It is an injustice when you have a growing income inequality that see fewer and fewer Americans becoming richer and richer and more Americans working harder and getting left behind. It is an injustice when working families in this country have actually gone backwards over the past 10 years when you add in inflation. It is a shame that in this nation today, with all our progress, you still have 1 out of 5 children in poverty. That is a shame. It is repugnant to the concept of a minimum wage to say that this $9 wage is what we had in mind. Franklin Delano Roosevelt started the minimum wage. And he said it is a wage that doesn't just allow you to subsist, but to live a decent life. You cannot live and support a family on $18,000 per year in the state of New York, period. That's why we have to raise the minimum wage.
That's Governor Andrew Cuomo. I have this vision of Colin O'Malley from Metro Justice falling out of his chair when you heard that. What was your reaction?
You know, I was there in the crowd, and had I had a chair, I probably would have fallen out of it. You know, it's a rare day that I get to say this, but I'm excited to for the moment. I 100% agree with Governor Cuomo there.
Okay. Kent Gardner, just some basic facts. The governor is pointing out that when you don't attach the wage to inflation, if it stays the same year to year, it does decline in actual value. Yes?
Sure, but that's he's making a point that's very different from simply indexing a wage to the minimum wage to inflation.
Okay, but I think he's pointing out, though, that if we don't change it, if we don't raise it year to year, it's less than it was last year, it's less than it was 5 years ago.
And I believe in gravity, too, so.
that is a basic idea. When it comes to the question of $15 across the board, Chris Wiest, RBA, has come out with some statements about this, Unshackle Upstate as well, other business groups. Give me a sense for just the basic capsule of your opinion, first of all.
Well, sure. So we're hearing quite a bit of feedback from our members, as you expect. We have, we're the Regional Chamber of Commerce, so we have about 1,500 members. A lot of them are sole props, small business owners. And across the board, they're very concerned. When you talk about a 67% jump in the minimum wage from what's projected to go into effect at the end of this year, there's no doubt it would have a significant impact on their way of doing business.
What would the impact be that they're telling you? Are they talking about cutting jobs if this is the wage? What are they talking about?
Those are some of the concerns. I had a conversation with a local CEO from a nonprofit 2 weeks ago. And her concern was that, you know, if this were to go into effect at the full level, she may be forced to reduce staff and to cut services. And that's part of the unintended consequences component to this. There's things that may play out that really weren't anticipated when they first went through, and that's some of the collateral damage that could come from this. You might see a pullback in services offered by nonprofits, county governments, those sorts of things.
All right, so again, if you're just joining us, it's not just the fast food industry that the governor would like to see the $15 minimum wage for. He's talking about statewide. The Pew Research Center finds that about 20.6 million Americans are near minimum wage workers. That's about 30% of all hourly non-self-employed workers who are 18 and older. So maybe not right on the minimum wage where they are, but near it. Jobs that pay $15 an hour or less, there are many, but Yahoo Finance reminds us that we're talking about the following where they would see a pretty big increase. Bank tellers, around $10.50 an hour now. Bakers, receptionists, and information clerks, nursing, psychiatric, and home health aides, around $10 an hour. Laborers and freight stock movers, around $9.50. Material moving workers, $9.50. Taxi drivers and chauffeurs, stock clerks and other fillers, textile and garment pressers. The list goes on there. These are nowhere near $15. They would be moved up to $15. And Colin O'Malley, on the program in the past, we've talked about your view that businesses say what we just heard from Chris. You think that the reality wouldn't reflect that, the sort of, if not widespread job loss, unintended consequences of lost jobs.
Yeah, I'm starting to follow along with the trend of calling this Chicken Little economics. The notion that that rises in the minimum wage are consistently attached to job losses, that they're attached to service losses. I mean, if you listen to the same business community, they've said that over every single raise of the minimum wage, over the creation of the minimum wage, over the creation of Social Security, over the creation of Medicare. And when you actually look at like peer-reviewed studies, when you look at this, I brought this in before, and I'll quote it again, it's a meta-regression of studies. It's a study of studies looking back and finding publication bias in studies. And that's, I don't think, shocking when there's so much profit tied to the question of minimum wage. They find minimum wage effect literature is contaminated by publication selection bias, which we estimate to be slightly larger than average. They actually found over the course of the study that it was considerably higher than they thought. And once this is corrected, there's little to no evidence of a negative association between minimum wage and employment. I think that when we look at the debate that rages around this, makes a lot of sense. There's constantly reports coming out all the time saying very different information about what actually will happen. And I just want to look to, you know, the National Association of Manufacturers said in 1949, and this is a larger minimum wage jump, right? 1949, the minimum wage is pushed 88% up in 1 year. It goes from 40 cents an hour to 75 cents an hour. The National Association of Manufacturing says that the hike would be a reckless jolt to the economic system. Unemployment plummeted, went from 5.9% to 2.9% over the course of the next 3 years.
All right, so before I bring it over to Kent Gardner, an economist in the studio, I just want to follow up with, to make sure I understand some of what Colin is saying, because in the past, you and I have also talked about the fact that, as a thought experiment, if the minimum wage went to $50 an hour tomorrow, you'd have to agree that there would be job cuts, yes?
You know, I don't know. I really don't know.
Please,
I mean,
it could.
Well, no, but let's be honest. Also, at the same time,
let's be honest.
The vast majority of low wage workers right now are working in giant businesses. It's something like 66% of. Here, I'll pull it
really?
Up.
Really?
Yeah,
that,
sure.
That's actually
let's
surprising to me too.
No, I know you guys love to say that the majority of employers are small employers, but that's just not like that.
The majority of employers are large employers. Absolutely
but the
true.
The majority
so
of people
majority
are employed by large employers.
I won't disagree with that, but the notion. I mean, let's just work with Evan's thought experiments. The minimum wage goes to $50. You're unwilling to acknowledge that there'd be some reduction in employment. Come on.
I think there might be some reduction in employment in some places, but let's. I think we need to talk about the other side of that. There would also be massive spending in the pockets of some of the poorest Americans right now, and more importantly, we would see an incredible drop in concentrated poverty in this country, which we're paying for every day.
Only if there were no collateral damage. I mean, you're making a caterer's pair. This assumption, which is what economists like to talk about. All other things being equal, we increase the pay to a lot of people, and sure, we'd have these marvelous changes in income, but you know that's just really a fanciful notion.
Well, but hold on. Let me just jump in and go back to Colin, because if there is a $50 minimum wage and there's some job loss, and then we're just sort of haggling over where we think that line of diminishing returns would be. And some people think, boy, $10 an hour, don't go past it. Some people say $9. Some people say $11. But most of what I think you are referring to, Colin, and I could be wrong, I want to ask you, most of what I think you're referring to, this kind of data, looks at what we might call these incremental changes in the minimum wage, which you are right from what I can tell an economist, and Kent will weigh in here. When we talk about a quarter, 75 cents, a dollar, you know, a 10% increase in the minimum wage, a 15%, there's often Chicken Little type talk, and there's usually sort of a really kind of a marginal impact from what I've seen. But we're not talking about that. We are talking about $15 an hour, and I don't know if there's data that looks at that big a jump. Am I wrong?
I just gave you data that looks at that big a jump.
That big of a jump?
88%. Raise the minimum wage from 49 to 50.
That's a single event and occurred wake of World War II. We were in a very, very different labor situation there. And I haven't looked at that specifically, so I'm not even willing to necessarily buy your argument. But it was a single instance. You know, take a look at a piece that Brookings released recently. You know, Brookings, the notorious right-wing think tank, released a piece where they were talking about the matter in terms of proportionality. And that's really where the argument has to get. And that's why, Evan Sought experiment is an appropriate one. You ask the question, there's a reductio ad absurdum point where you say, this is ridiculous, raising the minimum wage to $50 would have a reduction. Now, we could debate papers. There's another meta-analysis, another 24 studies that suggest that the impact is mildly negative for small changes within certain sectors. The question really is about where the minimum wage sits relative to the median wage, because it's all about proportionality. The median wage, the relationship between the minimum wage and the median wage has never been at the level we would be at if we went to $15 an hour.
Median wage now in New York City is around 20 and statewide is around 16. Is that wrong?
Yeah, it's a little higher than 16. I mean, I don't actually have the statewide numbers. I've got the numbers by metro. 2014 number for Rochester specifically is $17.36. But if we take a look at Utica, it's $15.37. Glens Falls, $15.30. So you've got very different labor markets. New York City's median wage is $22.
All right, that's one of the reasons, by the way, for our listeners who might be wondering. That's why there have been proposals when the minimum wage goes up to have New York City's go higher. But before we go back to that, and I think it's an important point, let me frame the question in a different way. And I want to frame it in a way that Colin has sort of been hinting at. And I'm going to ask Chris this question. We know we've got a poverty problem. Mm-hmm. We know that we have a concentrated poverty problem in this community that most city, I don't think a single city of this size, roughly in the country, has this problem. Now, I don't know that there's a single silver bullet to fix that. And I know the Anti-Poverty Initiative is working on it. But some of what others have said, David K. Johnston's come on this program and said, we have to make a values choice as a society, that we're not going to accept that. And if that means businesses have to learn to operate with a minimum wage of X, whatever that is, that's the values choice we have to make. And right now we're not doing a good enough job with that. What do you think?
Well, and I'll respond to that, but let me piggyback on something that was said earlier. We don't have to go back 50 years. We can talk about what's happening with some significant wage increases now. Seattle, San Francisco, we've seen a $15 an hour minimum wage go into effect there. And there's some evidence right now that there's been some job loss. Now, there's some competing opinions on that, but again, there is some more modern-day contemporary examples of where a significant increase in minimum wage can have a negative impact on jobs. That'll lead me into your question, Evan, with regard to addressing poverty. It seems at the surface that by raising minimum wage, that will elevate, lift all boats. However, if there aren't jobs, you're not gonna help anyone. Let me speak to a former career of mine. I was an HR manager, and I did a lot of recruiting. And one of the things I looked for on resumes, I just wanted to see a job. I didn't care what the job was. I just wanted to see that first job so we could discuss experience, so I could see if this individual would have the right skill sets, the right attitude, someone who I could hire and work with. There is a concern, and I think a legitimate concern, that if there are fewer job opportunities because of an increased minimum wage, there may not be that career. There may not be that ladder that'll help elevate people out of poverty.
Okay. Do you disagree with the governor's framing of the minimum wage being one that is not supposed to be one where you're working and you're still in poverty?
I think there's a lot of well-intended rationale behind this proposal. And I think I'm going to go back to something I said earlier, unintended consequences. You see many of that fallout. So, for example, the thought that anyone who is in poverty right now is going to benefit from this $15 minimum wage increase, I think, may be misplaced too. If you're an employer and you're paying minimum wage right now, which is $8.75, and you're told that tomorrow you have to start paying $15 an hour, you're likely to hire the most qualified, best candidate you can. That may be someone with a college degree, an advanced degree. That may not be someone right now who does not have that, might have a high school degree, maybe doesn't even have that, who is in poverty. That's a disconnect. So thinking that right now this $15 an hour increase, should it go through, will benefit all those that are currently impoverished, that may not happen.
We're talking about a $15 minimum wage. The governor wants to see it happen statewide. His appointed wage board passed that kind of a plan for the fast food sector, and the governor has said he wants the legislature to get on board. In a minute, you're going to hear from Joe Morelli on this subject. We talked about it earlier this summer. I think it's worth revisiting that. And if you're waiting on the phones, and a lot of people are, we're going to get to you. I want Colin to have a chance to respond to some of what he's just heard as well. Go ahead, Colin.
Yeah, you know, let's go more recent. So when raising the minimum wage above $5.15, the CEO of Domino's, David Brandon, said that this would be that if the minimum wage were increased, there would be price inflation for consumers and we would likely employ fewer people. According to their own filings on how many people they employ, they currently employ around 220,000 people, which is 70,000 more than they employed in 2004 when that raise went through. I think when you look at these sort of questions, I think that they're consistently there's a really inflated impact thrown out by the business community to scare people away from what could be, I think, pretty promising results. And let's be clear, we are currently still paying for these things, right? The fast food industry alone, you're looking at about $3.5 billion in benefits to their low wage workers because they're not paying their workers enough to not qualify for SNAP, to not qualify for Section 8, while they're still profiting in the billions themselves.
Kent Gardner, what do you make of that?
Well, the challenge here is that we can't make policy by anecdote. And so your Domino's example, I'm afraid, isn't persuasive to me. At the same time, business community, I agree the business community, often is susceptible to Chicken Little arguments, saying that this is a terrible thing. And I think what we have to recognize is that the truth is, as always, is in the middle. And there isn't an economist in the country that would not agree with the proposition that an increase in the minimum wage at some point reduces employment, that the consensus is that there will be some employment loss once that minimum wage pops above about 55% of the median wage. So it's a question of proportionality. And so an increase in the minimum wage is going to help some people. It's going to hurt some people. Well, Douglas Holtz Eakin, for example, used the same methodology he's used for when he was the head of the Congressional Budget Office and assessed what the consequences would be of a $15 national minimum wage. And his conclusion was that the net income would increase about $105 billion. But we would lose about 6.6 million jobs. And that's really the trade-off that we're looking at here. You can't raise the minimum wage without there being collateral damage. So there are arguments in favor of an increase in the minimum wage up to a point, but you just have to recognize that it's not infinite. $15 would be unprecedented, and it would be much, much higher. When you think about $15 being equal to the median wage for some of the metropolitan areas in the state of New York, that is a very, very large number.
Would it drag the median wage upward, Kent?
There would be compression across all wage levels, and we would see the median wage, of course it would go up. And the one of the consequences of that would certainly be inflation, and it would put the state of New York in a different competitive position relative to other states.
Okay.
So, I'm sorry, I got to get in on a couple of things here. One, you're comparing the median incomes of some of the poorest cities in the country, right? I mean, if our comparative marker on some of this is Rochester and Buffalo and Utica, we're looking at cities with 35% rates of poverty.
Those happen to be places where the minimum wage would increase. That's a perfectly relevant question.
Absolutely. But we are dealing with, if the bar that you're setting is one of the poorest cities in the country,
that's exactly the point, is that a minimum wage has to be proportional to the character of the economy.
I made a real point not to talk over you.
Okay.
Secondarily.
Everyone relax here. We're all nice people. We may disagree. Colin,
certainly.
Go ahead.
Secondarily, I'd also say if you're going to talk about inflation, you should acknowledge that we've just gone through a quarter of deflation in this country, and there's incredible fear on the part of many economists that we're looking at deflationary periods, that we've seen consistent drops in unemployment with no real raises in income and wages. So, if we're going to talk about inflation, we should talk about the fact that we've had basically negative, nil inflation in the last quarter and almost none in the last year. you know, I think deflation should be something that people are a little more concerned about. And when we're talking about raising wages, I think we should also tie it to a real conversation about the actual results of poverty wages right now. $15 an hour is at full-time work is $31,200 a year. That is not an excessive and incredible amount of money. That's one that most families would barely make it by on.
There's not a disagreement in the world that that's a that we would love to have incomes higher, and it would be extraordinarily difficult to raise a family on minimum wage. There's no disagreement.
No, I agree with Kent on that. However, so now we're talking about the reality of making those numbers work. And if you're an employer in the state of New York and you're facing some of the highest taxes and regulations in the nation, and this is real, we're on top of all the list. You know it. Well, we have the fourth highest workers' comp costs. We have some of the highest gas taxes. We have some highest energy taxes. You can just go down the list. We've all seen the lists. That's a reality. And that's what employers have to deal with. So now you're talking about a potentially 67% increase in payroll, which is also one of their largest costs. And I'll tell you what, if you're an employer in the southern tier, maybe one of the poorer areas, and you're looking across the border at Pennsylvania that's at $7.25 for minimum wage, you have options. You have choices. That's not saying you have to continue to stay or even expand your operations here. You have choices, and that's the sort of concern we have in terms of job losses, and that's a very real thing.
Well, Chris, let me try a different thought experiment, because I asked Colin, $50 an hour, you think there'd be job loss. Is there a minimum wage increase higher than a nickel that RBA would say thumbs up to?
I don't know that.
You can't say a single minimum wage increase that would be?
You know what, Evan, what I would say is look to the market, because even before there were the minimum wage increases that we talked about, fast food places, you know, some of the big box stores, they were still increasing their wages above minimum wage back then because they had to. They had to have a more attractive wage to be able to hire employees. So you're seeing that. That's an ongoing sort of thing. I don't know what the number is, to be honest with you. Right. I agree with what Ken said. I mean, you can't raise a family on $8.75 on $9 an hour. But to me, the conversation needs more to be along the lines of what can we do to elevate people beyond that? Get them that job that allows them to develop into those higher paying positions. That's where there should be more uniform agreement.
Okay. Should there be a minimum wage?
Sure.
Okay. Ken, and before we move to the callers, because we're all flooded out here with phone calls and feedback as we talk about a $15 minimum wage or elsewhere, is there, in your look at what economists have been looking at in terms of the impact of minimum wage, is there somewhere, as you say, in the middle that we ought to be aiming for right now that looks more reasonable and effective to you?
You know, it's difficult. One of the challenges we have is that we talk about a national minimum wage or we talk about a statewide minimum wage, and yet we're looking at vastly different labor markets. And it was my point to Colin before is that it's quite appropriate to ask what the impact of a New York statewide minimum wage is on a poor region like Utica. Or on a poor region, a poor region like Rochester. So there's if you look at the Cates Index, and that's that proportion of minimum wage to the median wage, it varies a lot over the state. And, we're looking at, the long-run average for across all of the OECD, all of Europe, the United States has historically been around 0.5, 0.55. And, we don't generally go above that. I'm not saying that that is necessarily the only place to be, but it would seem, again, that there's consensus among economists that if you don't move much above that 0.55, the impact on job loss is modest. So we have places where, in New York City, of course, is the example, where the Cates Index is well below 0.5, and New York City probably could afford an increase in minimum wage without having a dramatic impact.
Joe Morelli made some comments on this program earlier this summer. We're not going to play them, Val. They're too long, and I can already see what's happening this hour. We're going to lose the hour before we even blink with all the phone calls and whatnot. But let me just sum up what Joe said earlier this summer. He is interested in at least looking at attaching the minimum wage to inflation. He would like to see perhaps a little bit more of an aggressive schedule toward the end, maybe an extra increase on the end. He was not talking about $15 an hour. He was uncomfortable with the notion of a single industry like fast food being awarded an increase in the minimum wage while leaving others at the same way. He was concerned about automation and a lot of different things there. But when it comes to attaching to inflation, he said, maybe it's time for that. Now, Kent, you always deflate this balloon because you say there are problems even with attaching to inflation. But I feel like that's the perfect being the enemy of the good here, because we have this conversation every 6 months or every year when we don't attach it to inflation.
Well, I agree. And, economists really struggle with this because you kind of bake in inflation. When we had high inflation, you tied everything to inflation. You're almost guaranteeing that inflation wouldn't wouldn't fall. That's a technical problem. I mean, philosophically, I completely agree. But the larger point is to recognize that the cost of living varies and the labor market varies from metro to metro. So I think a more important question should be whether we have a minimum wage that is universal across all industries, across all regions, across all metros.
Okay. Chris, attached to inflation?
Well, indexing presents its own set of challenges. I just talked a little bit about the competitive imbalance between us and neighboring states, even like Pennsylvania. When you have a national, federal minimum wage, I suppose that that tends to level the playing field a little bit more. But you know, I agree with Ken. It's not as simple a solution as you might think.
Colin, attached to inflation.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good move to make, but I should say, though, that I think what it does is it roughly enshrines the purchasing power of the current minimum wage that you set it at. So I would be really wary of setting it to inflation at its current rate, because what that means is you're saying that the current minimum wage has roughly the purchasing power that we would like to see into infinity, and I think that I'm really wary of that.
Move to 15 and set to inflation. Yes?
Yeah.
Okay, that's what. Let's take a short break, and we're going to spend the second half hour working through your phone calls, your comments, and questions for our panel. Kent Gardner, the chief economist with the Center for Governmental Research, Colin O'Malley, the organizing director for Metro Justice, Chris Wiest, the vice president of public policy with the Rochester Business Alliance, talking about the minimum wage, continues next on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Thursday on The Next Connections, the impact of divorce on children. You might have seen the viral video, the father inviting the stepfather to walk his daughter down the aisle, and the joy that brought. But a lot of divorce ends in families being very competitive with a rough impact on kids. We look at that. Then second hour, is Rochester an art town that doesn't buy art? And can that change? Talk to you Thursday.
Hello, I'm Ken Glazer, honorary co-chair for WXXI's Go Public campaign. Each day, I turn to WXXI for news programming that engages and challenges me. It's important that we keep local, independent journalism strong in Rochester. Please join me in support of the Go Public campaign. Make a gift online at wxxi.org/gopublic. And thank you for your support.
Welcome back to Connections. First up on the phones talking minimum wage is Steve in Fairport. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, it's an interesting conversation that you're having. What's absent is that owner of that pizza chain makes $4,000 an hour. There's a revolution that's just about to happen. You have so many people that have been downtrodden for so many years, while the 1% makes 900% more than they did 20 years ago. The whole thing is cooked. The whole thing is something that is outrageous. I feel it's outrageous to try to support a family for $8 an hour. I think it's outrageous for Norm Silverstein of your television station to make over $250,000. I think it's all outrageous. I'm telling you now, the laws have to change in the United States, and that's what this election is going to be all about. The Democrats are going to hammer $15 an hour, and that's who's going to win the White House next time. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Let me just go around the table. Colin, I suspect you agree with a lot of what you just heard.
Well, yeah, and it actually falls in line with a lot of what I was going to say. Like, I don't expect, to be perfectly frank, I don't expect a lot of the political class in our country, I don't expect the RBAs of the world to be on board with a substantial increase in minimum wage anytime soon. But the reason that this is a conversation is because low-wage workers all over this country are finding a voice and finding a strength that they haven't had in decades. There was a Time magazine headline not too long ago that said low-wage workers are storming the barricades. And to be perfectly frank, I think that we need to see another few decades of a considerably greater deal of low-wage worker power in this country.
David on Twitter jumps in to say, wait, a pizza shop owner makes $4,000 per hour. You're just going to let that one go? I think he's talking about a big company, pizza chain, Domino's.
Yeah.
And so, David, there are some CEOs that do, and I take David's point that a lot of people don't, including Rumit, who writes to us on Twitter, I own a small sub shop, and every $1 increase in the minimum wage will cost me $12,000 per year. $72,000 is the cost to me if we go to $15 an hour. Definitely an impact. So, Colin, the guy who owns the small sub shop who just writes in is not the CEO of Domino's, right?
Certainly not, no.
Okay, Chris?
No, and that's an important distinction. Thank you for clarifying that, Evan, because a lot of these examples that we see of these corporate CEOs with large salaries, Fortune 500 types. That is not your average employer. That certainly isn't the average employer within the RBA membership. We have members, small businesses, where quite honestly, you take out the cost of doing business, paying payroll for employees, everything else, they may not be making $15 an hour. That's more closer to reality for what you're seeing out there for employers versus the, you know, the CEO at some Fortune 500 company that
But you don't deny, Chris, do you, that CEO to worker pay has done this over the years? The hands are going apart. Big difference now.
It's gotten bigger. It has. The gap has gotten bigger. But I think, again, there's a lot of cherry-picked examples which are showing the most egregious ones, which are, again, these Fortune 500 CEOs. That's not the employers that you see, rank-and-file employers across the state.
Kent?
You know, I have to side more with the caller, Chris. I mean, there are a lot of small business owners, but I do think that the salaries of people at you know, hedge fund managers and a lot of the corporate CEOs are making really an obscene amount of money. And I think that the concern, I really do have a concern about social unrest with the kind of income disparities
you
we're
do.
Seeing right now. I do.
Well, and my point, Ken, is we don't have any hedge fund managers within our 1,500 members in the Rochester
Business
Alliance.
Talking about RBA, but...
No, but I'm saying that's a more...
I understand.
And I think our membership is more representative of what you're going to see across the state.
In terms of total numbers. But, yep. But you know, I agree. But I do think that the problem with executive pay is serious.
See, for those who think this is a stacked discussion, now we've got Colin and Kent agreeing on this, on certain things. Let me get back to the phones. Michael in Canandaigua is next. Go ahead, Michael.
Michael, hi, how are you doing
yeah,
today?
Go ahead.
Great
good
conversation. I just really wanted to make two points. You know, the first being really the global economy, and you know, just looking at China, you know, the reason we're there is because the wages are so low. That's why companies go there. And no doubt costs are very high in New York. And, you know, the second point is that the velocity of money, I think if you take some of that money and put it back into, you know, regular working folks' pockets, it is going to spur economic development. People are going to have more money to spend and, you know, just put more money into the economy. You know, the median wage for the average American is pretty much stagnant and has declined. And it's tough compared to, you know, like you say, the CEOs who make a lot of money. It'd be nice if there was a way to get some of that money back into regular people's pockets and spur spending and just get a higher velocity of money in the economy so everybody's out. And I think that would increase the demand for goods and services here locally in New York and across the nation. And, you know, those are kind of my two points. And this is a great conversation. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much for the phone call. Michael, Chris Wiest, I'll start with you. What do you think?
Caller's point is well taken. There's, you know, employers have options, and if payroll is one of their most expensive costs, which it is, they may look at other markets, be it going to a China for labor or being a neighboring state. We talked earlier about the degree of the increase here. The next closest state is $9.15. It's both Connecticut and Vermont. You're talking about going to $15 an hour here in New York State, so that's a significant difference.
Colin?
I mean, I think we should actually just look at the bind that this sort of, you know, let's listen to the market ideology puts us in, right? It puts us in one where we say, well, we can't really raise wages because we might move to China. But the reason we can move to China is because we tore down all trade barriers over the last 50 years. So, you know, I think, you know, what we've said over the years in circles talking about these sort of trade deals from a worker justice perspective is that they institute a clear race to the bottom where we have no choice but to what? Do we want to see the living standard of the United States go to that of the working class in China? Like, is that the intention here? Because it seems to be a trap that the business community and the political class of this country is trying to put people in.
Unfair or fair, Kent?
You know what? That is such a long conversation.
It is.
You know, if we were to erect tariff barriers and rely only on our own resources in the United States, we'd be a much poorer nation.
Let me just get a quick comment. And I want to direct this to Colin because I'm hearing from some small business folks out there. This is from MJ says, I just have one comment, and that is, how about more consideration for small business owners? And by small, I mean a small farm-based family business. Think a small organic farm, not a corporate farm. What if a small business owner makes close to minimum wage themselves and then is forced to pay an employee several dollars more an hour than the owner is making? That is the case for many small business family owners, especially in the micro-agricultural sector. As a small family farm business owner, I too am forced to make critical financial decisions to put food on my own table. Combine that with the fact of the real rising cost of doing doing business, increased taxes, credit card fees, and all the other costs of business increases that have accumulated in the last 10 years. It's an important distinction, and it's also important to remember that some small business owners are among the low-wage earners. What do you think, Colin?
Well, I think that's an incredibly valuable point, and I think what we really should do is actually think about, like, if we're going to talk about small businesses all the time, even though they are the minority employers of low-wage employers, but if we're going to talk about them, I think we should talk about them in a very real way, right? The National Federation of Independent Businesses has done a number of surveys of their own membership, and they find that poor sales consistently outrank cost of labor as the major issue, right? And I think we should, consistently outrate as their first priority, their first problem that they would say with their business, right? Now, if we're gonna talk about some of those things, I think what we should do is talk about how, as a small farmer, Monsanto is putting a squeeze on you, how major agribusiness is putting a squeeze on you, right? When the only people we look towards are those downward, those that are trying to fight for some basic humility and basic dignity in their lives, and those are the people that have to solve all the problems of the economy, I think that's a real problem. I think instead we should look at how did Walmart drive out most home hardware companies. I think that's an incredibly interesting conversation we could have.
I understand that point, but I'm also trying to look at, if the governor gets this $15 an hour minimum wage, what you're talking about, the kind of solution you're talking about, is a much more complex solution.
Certainly.
That would help those small family farms, small businesses, mm-hmm. right? And without more of what you're talking about, with just a wage increase, mm-hmm. and they don't have other supports,
Certainly.
Are they out of business?
No, I wouldn't immediately say that everyone's out of business. I have no idea. I'm not running their business. I do think if your business is such that you can't provide the people that work for you and that make money for you, if you can't provide them a decent livelihood, then something is fundamentally wrong with either your business or the economy. And I think that those are larger questions. I think that more often than not, we see small businesses tend to side with, the NFIB, for instance, that represents Walmart in a much greater degree than they represent small businesses.
That's not what they would say.
Absolutely not what they would say, but we can always look at their funding. So I think that there are very large questions, and that the wage is one piece of them. And I do think that the movement, the Fight for 15 out there, that whose motto or slogan or whatever is at this point 15 and a union. That's trying to address the larger question. The union piece is trying to address the larger question of who has say in our economy generally. And I think that over time, we're going to find that small businesses actually would gain a lot from siding more with that side of the argument.
Got to get back to the phones, but on Twitter, just one more for Kent, a man named Sir. Sir wants to know, why penalize a CEO for running his or her company successfully enough that they can be rewarded with a high salary?
Well, I think that when you've got a situation where you've got an entrepreneur who really has made the business work, you know, I completely agree. I mean, I'm certainly happy to see compensation for people who've created tremendous value. But I think if you look at most corporate boardrooms, corporate CEO salaries, I think are reinforced because the boards of directors are generally populated with other CEOs from other Fortune 500 companies. There's a real group think that goes around about how much they should be paid and what their stock option should be. And I think that really does drive salaries that I think are absolutely excessive.
Okay. Back to the phones. And this is Paul in Brighton. Next up, go ahead, Paul.
Yeah, I think we're mixing two different things here. On the one hand, people, individuals, need a certain amount of money just to live. There's no question about that. And some people say it's $15 an hour, some people say it's 20, some people say it's 12. Then we have a second problem, which is businesses need to be run in such a way that they're making a profit, that they're running efficiently. Those are two completely separate things. Now, one way that we've addressed the matter of providing people with what they need, not everyone likes this approach, is to have government pay them. If someone needs money, a minimum amount of money, let the government provide it for them and let the business go ahead and pay some incremental amount of money to those who are extra productive and doing an extremely good job. And then everyone gets the minimum they need, as is being advocated by some people in your program. And let the so-called invisible hand, I think Adam Smith came up with that one, let the influence the rest of the economy, providing people with goods and services in the most efficient way.
Okay. Thanks for the comments. I'm going to start with Kent Gardner, the economist with the Center for Governmental Research. Kent?
Yeah, I think Paul's characterization of this is really very appropriate, that you know, we really do have two different problems to solve. And to the extent that we solve a problem in a particular way, sometimes we exacerbate another problem. It's one of the reasons why economists like the earned income tax credit as opposed to the minimum wage. The earned income tax credit is a much more targeted tool. It does, in fact, put money in the hands of people who are in poverty, people who can't earn a significant wage. And it doesn't create that distortion that you see with an arbitrary and, I think in case of $15, you know, really excessive minimum.
Okay, Chris Wiest.
Yeah, and I agree with what Kent's just saying. There are other options. The earned income tax credit being one to be helpful. If you take a look again at some of the experience we're seeing coming out of Seattle and San Francisco that did go to the $15 an hour minimum wage and some of the projected job loss, one of the theories behind that may be individuals taking themselves out of the workforce or reducing their hours so they wouldn't lose governmental benefits. Maybe they were receiving some social assistance or child care, those sorts of things. So consumers are going to make the decisions that are going to be most beneficial to them. But we do need to find a way to, I'll go back to my earlier theme, from a workforce development standpoint, allow individuals to have the skills, to have the talents, the education that's going to allow them to elevate. To advance into the higher paying positions. That's how you're ultimately going to solve this problem.
Colin O'Malley from Metro Justice.
I hesitate to call these two separate problems. I think that they are a very intimately connected problem. One might call it a bit of a contradiction. I think that, you know, it's important that working people can actually afford a livelihood. And most working people in this country are in the labor market where they work for a business. So if that's the case, then I think we need to really rethink the way that those businesses work. And I think we need to really talk about what profit is, right? Can McDonald's make the profit that they make without 700,000 employees working for them all over the country? If there's nobody there to serve you a burger or take your money, can they make the money they make? And I think it's pretty clear that the answer there is no. So, in fact, it's not just a CEO. It's not just a business. It's not just a board of directors making that money. It is, in fact, a team of like 700,000-some people making that money. And many of them are being given impoverished wages because of their power structure within that team.
I think it's sometimes maybe a little disingenuous to jump to Walmart or McDonald's. I mean, you know, I think, you know, why don't we talk about Tom Walls, for example? And because I think, you know, that's a much smaller company. And, you know, the big companies, there's so many arguments you could make about McDonald's. So I think it's important, I think, not to just bring up the, you know, the big corporate boogeyman, but also look at smaller businesses.
Let me go ahead.
I'll just be interested. I mean, do you have any details on Tom Wall's profitability? Do you have any details on how many people they employ? Because if you do, I'd love to dive into that conversation too.
Yeah, I don't have that at my fingertips. Mean, no, but it's I think that again, the notion that it's very easy to hate McDonald's, it's very easy to hate Walmart, and we know that the people at the top of those organizations are making phenomenal incomes.
I'd be interested to clarify, like, I don't know that Tom Walls is a small business. I'd guess they have over 100 employees. I would say on most
you
scales,
you don't regard 100 employees as a small business?
Well, my understanding is that most scales that look at this don't look at 100 employees as small business.
How usually, does RBA classify, Chris? What's the small business?
I mean,
business?
Usually when you see the stuff, you know, in what? Governmental circles, it's 50.
I mentioned 1,500 members. About 80% of our employers, our members, have 25 or fewer employees.
Okay, but
so when I hear that there aren't a lot of small employers that may be impacted by this, from our experience, and I'll tell you, similar to other chambers across New York, that's pretty typical.
But just definitionally, is Tom Walls a small business?
By some, the fair standard is there is a sliding scale on it. The different organizations have different
compared to
numbers.
McDonald's, I think they're a very small business.
Absolutely. Sure. But the point that's being lost here, let's go back to the caller earlier, the farmer. Who was calling about some of his challenges. And I think what he was really asking or suggesting is that there are a number of other burdens that they're facing as small employers, in addition to the minimum wage, are making it hard for them to be successful, profitable. Are there other things the state can be doing to help strengthen companies. I mentioned earlier, we have the fourth highest workers' comp costs in the nation. We have some of the highest taxes. We have some of the highest regulations. Those are the sorts of things that, quite honestly, we need to be visiting in tandem with this issue to try to make businesses stronger so they can offer more job opportunities.
So I'd be interested in highlighting actually one of those that she brought up really quickly, because I'd be interested to see if the RBA would take it on in this way. She talked about credit card processing fees. Now, in card processing fees is one of the costs that she raised, and increasing card processing fees is one of them that she raised. Is that it, would the RBA be similarly interested in tackling an issue put down by a company as by government?
I'd have to understand the issue more. To be honest with you, I'm not familiar enough with it.
Fair enough.
That's not something that any of our members have brought to our attention as a significant issue.
She just did.
All right, I don't know if she's a member.
So.
All right, back to the phones. Don, East Rochester. Been waiting. Go ahead, Don.
Hello. I'd like to go back to what one of your previous callers mentioned, that they should have the government subsidize workers' wages. Well, the government already is subsidizing workers' wages in the form of that people at Walmart or other corporations can't make enough, so they turn to food stamps, Section 8 housing, and so on. But my major points are that the greatest danger to RBA members is not the raising of the minimum wage. The greatest danger to a small hardware store is if Home Depot moves in down the street. They can undercut their sales and drive them out of business. That's what the greatest danger is to small businesses. Secondly, if you raise the minimum wage, you're raising the ability of people to buy back the goods and services that are being produced, and that cuts back, that mitigates the effect of overproduction, which leads to recessions and depressions. So the major threat to small businesses that are of the RBA caliber are larger businesses, because the trajectory is for more and more capital to be held in fewer and fewer hands.
Don, let me let Chris jump in there. Is he right? Is this hardware store, the small business hardware store that's a member of RBA, threatened most by a Home Depot moving in?
You know, that's really not the conversation I think we're having here right now about minimum wage. They're all going to be impacted by what we're talking about, the $15 increase. So, I mean, that to me, that's not – we have members that are small. We don't have as many retail members that are part of our membership, to be honest with you, but they're small and large companies that work in the same industries.
The way I take what Don's saying is they've got so much power with their size, and if they only have to pay employees a smaller amount, they can leverage even more. They can grow. They can come to your community, and if wages go up – yeah, the small business has to pay more, but so does Home Depot, and all of a sudden maybe they're not moving in on your corner store, no?
Depends on the benefit packages that the respective companies are offering, right? So Home Depot, some of those larger employers, and I don't know, I'm not privy to it, but they may have some more benefits that they're able to offer as part of their total compensation. I don't know. It's not an apples-to-apples comparison is what I'm saying.
Okay.
Ahead, Kent, you wanna...
go ahead, Kent, you want to jump in?
You know, it's just a completely different conversation, and I think, you know, we'd have to start in a different place. I agree with Chris. It's really not what we've been talking about. And it really does bring in all sorts of issues. I just don't think there's time to address.
Okay. Let me get back to the phones then, because, again, they're still all lit, and Bob in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Bob.
I went on to Tim in Pittsburgh.
Oh, Tim. I switched it over. Tim in
you
Pittsburgh.
You picked the right line. Come on. You knew it. I'll be quick.
Go ahead, Tim.
This is a reality. I know it's fun to go after McDonald's and Walmart and everything, and we should be going against all the evil large employers, but that may take time. In reality, you know, there's smaller businesses. This stuff happens right now. If the wage goes to $15 an hour, and I'm sorry, I mean, in high school, I flipped burgers and stuff, but if you're telling me that one of my fellow union electricians who starts off at 14-something an hour right now, it's already been brought up to increase their starting wage to $23 an hour now, and the company that I work for has already said that with all the people we have retiring, those jobs will just now go unfilled. They said they will do the bare minimum, basically, to fill that if something like that goes through and the union demands this minimum. Now, of course, there's some negotiation, but if you're telling me that an electrician and someone who serves you fries, I'm sorry, and no one wants to say it, are all of a sudden on the same level, technically, that cannot even be close to a valid argument. I mean, it would be great if everyone could earn $15 an hour, but there is a separation between jobs here. And I'm sorry, some of my guys have gone to school for years for this.
Okay,
Tim. Was there any argument from Colin there?
We're down about
not
two.
By the way.
Yeah, thank you, Tim. We're down about 2 minutes
all
left.
Right.
So, hold on a second. He directed it directly to Colin. So let me start with you, Colin.
Yeah, I would imagine that your union has the capability to really rapidly negotiate better wages for you immediately following a significant raise in wages for others. In fact, that's I think been part of the philosophy of the movement from the get-go.
So you're saying you think Tim's got a fundamental misunderstanding that because what he's saying is somebody who in his words flips burgers should not be making what his electricians are making.
Yeah, you know, I'm not going to put that kind of I think that there's a lot of problems in that kind of value judgment. I think that those value judgments between people can be incredibly problematic in a variety of ways. I think if you look at how people spend their money in this country, they actually are valuing burger flippers at a pretty high rate, and that none of that's coming back to those folks. So I say this as you know, my stepfather, my mother's boyfriend at the moment, he's an IBEW member. And has been, you know, most of his life and is about to retire in the IBEW. So, like, I don't say this as somebody who is disconnected from electrical workers. I do think that the IBEW has been very supportive of the fight for 15 locally. So I think that this will see wage increases correspond throughout the country. And I think the real issue is one of worker power. And as a union member, I think he understands what that means and to have some actual negotiating ability on the workplace.
Chris Wiest.
Well, and I think the other issue, there's not limitless dollars available here to pay for these significant increases. And one of the things that we really haven't touched on at all is the impact on the consumer, right? I mean, you take a look at who's ultimately going to be paying for this. So to have this electrician that's going to come in and all of a sudden maybe your bill is doubled or because of the increased wages or pick a job.
Or
it doesn't
matter. A pizza shop owner who says a lot of these are franchisees,
right.
And it's not the CEO of Domino's
exactly.
Who's going to be hurt. It's the franchisees, and they'll raise prices on what you're paying for pizza.
Exactly.
That's what an email is.
And let me also say there's a bit of a cascading effect here with employers, too. It's not just the $15 an hour wage increase, by the way. So it's also going to be Social Security that's going to go up. It's going to be disability. It's going to be unemployment. It's going to be workers' compensation. You're going to see significant increases across the board because those are all based on payroll. So there's a number of different areas that are going to be impacted by this.
This hour just vanished on us. Colin, do you think it's going to happen? Do you think a state? You've talked to people. I mean, the wage board for fast food said yes, but
yeah.
Statewide, do you think there's any chance?
I think a movement of worker power in this country is going to change a lot more than just this, and we're going to win this one too.
Okay. Kent Gardner, are we headed to a $15 minimum wage?
I'd be very surprised.
Okay. Chris, I think that you would probably be shocked if that happened.
A lot of conversation that's going to be occurring in this legislative session. We'll see what happens.
I do hope you'll all come back. And this was a very stimulating hour. Unbelievable amount of feedback from our listeners. We tried to get to as many of you as we could. My thanks to Colin O'Malley, the organizing director for Metro Justice. Thank you, Colin.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Chris Wiest, the vice president of public policy of RBA. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks.
Kent Gardner with CGR, the chief economist for CGR. Thank you, Kent.
Thank you, Evan.
Val LaBanca, the chief engineer of this broadcast. And the producer is Megan Mack. I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Member Supported Public Radio.